This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Butterfly Garden by Dot Hutchison, performed by Lauren Ezzo and Mel Foster. To Mom and Deb, because you were halfway through answering the question before you realized how deeply disturbing it was, and because everything else. Part 1. The techs tell him the girl on the other side of the glass hasn't said a word since they brought her in. It doesn't surprise him at first, not with the trauma she's been through. But watching her now from behind the one-way mirror, he starts to question that assessment. She sits slumped in the hard metal chair, chin resting on one bandaged hand, as the other traces nonsense symbols onto the surface of the stainless steel table. Her eyes are half closed, deep shadows bruising the skin beneath, and her black hair is dull and unwashed, scraped back into a messy knot. She's exhausted, clearly. But he wouldn't call her traumatized. Sipping his coffee, FBI Special Agent Victor Hanoverian studies the girl and waits for his team members to arrive. At least his partner, anyway. The third Corps member of their team is at the hospital with the other girls, trying to get updates on their conditions and, when possible, their names and fingerprints. Other agents and techs are at the property, and what little he's heard from them makes him want to call home and talk to his own daughters, make sure they're well. But he has a way with people, especially traumatized children, so it's the sensible choice for him to be here, waiting to go in and talk to this particular victim. He can see the faint pink lines around her nose and mouth from an oxygen mask, smudges of dirt and soot across her face and borrowed clothing. Bandages wrap around her hands and her upper left arm, and he can trace the bulky line of others beneath the thin undershirt someone at the hospital gave her to wear. She shivers in the off-green scrub pants, her bare feet pulled away from the cold floor, but doesn't complain. He doesn't even know her name. He doesn't know the names of most of the girls they rescued, or the ones they were far, far too late to save. This one hasn't talked to anyone but the other girls, and even then there were no names, no information, just, well, he can't really call it comfort. You'll die or you won't, now relax for the doctors so they can work. Wasn't exactly reassuring. But that's exactly how the other girls seem to take it. She sits up in the chair, her arms extending slowly over her head until her entire back is curved like a bowstring. The mics pick up the painful pop of vertebrae. Shaking her head, she slumps back over the table, her cheek pressed against the metal, her palms flat against the surface. She's facing away from the glass, away from him and the others she knows must be there. But the angle offers another piece of interest. The lines. The hospital gave him a picture of it. He can see just the edges of those brilliant colors peeking out against the back of her shoulder. The rest of the design is harder to see, but the undershirt isn't thick enough to obscure it completely. He pulls the picture from his pocket and holds it up against the glass, looking between the glossy paper and what he can see of the design on the girl's back. It wouldn't be significant except that all but one of the girls have them. Different colors, different designs, but all the same in essentials. "You think he did that to them, sir?" asks one of the techs, watching the girl on the monitor. That camera is aimed from the other side of the interview room, showing an enlarged view of her face, her eyes closed. Her breaths slow and deep. "I guess we'll find out." He doesn't like to make suppositions, especially when they know so little yet. This is one of the very few times in his career where what they found is so much worse than they could have envisioned. He's accustomed to thinking the worst, When a child goes missing, you work your ass off, but don't expect to find the poor thing alive at the end of it. Maybe you hope. You don't expect. He's seen bodies so small, it's a wonder there are even coffins to fit them. Seen children raped before they know the meaning of the word. But somehow, this case is so unexpected he isn't quite sure where his footing is. He doesn't even know how old she is. The doctors guessed 16 to 22, but that doesn't help him much. As young as 16, she should probably have a representative from Child Services, but they've already swarmed the hospital and made things difficult. They have valuable and necessary services to provide, but that doesn't get them out of his way. He tries to think of his daughters, what they would do if they were locked in a room like this girl. But none of them are this self-contained. Does that mean she's older? Or just that she's had more practice seeming unaffected? Have we heard more from Edison or Ramirez yet? He asks the techs, not taking his eyes off the girl.
Edison's on his way up. Ramirez is still at the hospital with the parents of the youngest girl,
one of the women reports. Yvonne doesn't look at the girl in the room. Not even at the monitors. She has an infant daughter at home. Victor wonders if he should pull her off. This is only her first day back. But decides she'll say something if she can't handle it. She was the one who triggered the search?
Only been gone a couple of days. Disappeared from the mall while shopping with her friends. They said she went out of the dressing room area to switch sizes and never came back.
One less person to find. They had taken pictures at the hospital of all the girls, even the ones who died en route or on arrival, and were running them through the missing persons database. It will take time for results to come up, though. When agents or doctors ask the ones in better shape for their names, they turned to look at this girl, clearly a leader among them, and most said nothing. A few seemed to think about it before dissolving into sobs that brought the nurses running. But not this girl in the interview room. When they asked her, she just turned away. As far as anyone can tell, this is one girl with no interest in being found. Which makes some of them wonder if she's a victim at all. Victor sighs and drains the last of his coffee, crushing the cup before tossing it in the trash bucket by the door. He'd prefer to wait for Ramirez. Another female in the room is always helpful in circumstances like this. Can he wait for her? There's no telling how long she'll be with the parents, or if other parents will flock to the hospital once the photos are released to the media. If they're released to the media, he amends with a frown. He hates that part. Hates plastering the pictures of victims across television screens and newspapers, so there's never a way for them to forget what happened to them. At least they can wait until they get the missing persons data. The door opens and slams shut again behind him. The room is soundproof, but the glass rattles slightly, and the girl sits up quickly, eyes narrowed at the mirror, and presumably the ones she has to know are behind it. Victor doesn't turn around. No one slams a door quite like Brandon Edison. Anything?
They've matched a couple of fairly recent reports, and the parents are on their way. So far, it's all East Coast.
Victor pulls the picture from the glass and puts it back into the pocket of his jacket.
Anything else on our girl? Some of the others called her Maya after she was brought here. No last name.
Real name? Edison snorts.
Doubtful.
He struggles to zip his jacket over his Redskins t-shirt. Once the response team found the survivors, Victor's team was called in from off-duty to handle it. Given Edison's tastes, Victor's mostly grateful there are no naked women on the shirt.
We've got a team going through the main house to see if the bastard kept anything personal.
I think we can both agree that he kept some very personal things of theirs. Perhaps remembering what he saw at the property, Edison doesn't argue.
Why this one?
he asks. Ramirez says there are others not too badly injured, more frightened, maybe more willing to talk. This one looks like a tough nut. The other girls look to her. I want to know why. They must be desperate to get home, so why do they look at her and choose not to answer questions?
You think she might be part of this?
That's what we need to find out. Picking up the bottle of water from the counter, Victor takes a deep breath.
All right, let's go talk to Maya.
She sits back in the chair when they walk into the interview room, gauze-covered fingers laced together across her stomach. It's not as defensive a posture as he would expect, and it's clear from his partner's scowl that he's thrown by it as well. Her eyes flick over them, taking in details and filing away thoughts, none of which show on her face.
"Thank you for coming with us," he greets her, glossing over the lack of choice she'd been given. "This is Special Agent Brandon Edison, and I'm Special Agent in Charge Victor Hanoverian."
The corner of her mouth ticks upward in a fleeting movement he can't really call a smile.
"Special Agent in Charge Victor Hanoverian,"
she repeats, her voice hoarse with smoke.
"Quite a mouthful."
"Would you prefer Victor?"
"I don't really have a preference, but thank you."
He unscrews the cap and hands her the bottle of water, using the moment to adjust his strategy. Definitely not traumatized, and not shy either.
"Usually there's another part to the introductions."
"The helpful tidbits," she says. "You like to weave baskets and take long swims, and Edison likes to walk the streets in heels and a mini?"
Edison growls and slams a fist onto the table.
"What is your name?"
"Don't be rude."
Victor bites his lip against the temptation to smile. It won't help the situation, certainly won't help his partner's state of mind, but the temptation is there just the same.
"Would you please tell us your name?"
"Thank you, but no. I don't believe I care to share that."
"Some of the girls called you Maya."
"Then why did you bother to ask?"
He hears Edison's sharp intake of breath, but ignores it.
"We'd like to know who you are, how you came here. We'd like to help you get home."
"And if I said I don't need your help to get home?"
"I'd wonder why you didn't get home before this."
There's a not-quite smile and a flicker of an eyebrow that might be approval. She's a beautiful girl, with golden brown skin and pale brown, nearly amber eyes. But she's not soft. A smile will have to be earned.
"I think we both know the answer to that. But I'm not in there anymore, am I? I can get home from here."
"And where is home?"
"I'm not sure if it's there anymore."
"This isn't a game," Edison snaps.
The girl appraises him coolly.
"No, of course not. People are dead, lives are ruined, and I'm sure you were very inconvenienced at having to leave your football game."
Edison flushes, tugging the zipper up higher over his shirt.
"You don't seem all that nervous," Victor notes.
She shrugs and takes a sip of the water, holding the bottle gingerly in her bandaged hands.
"Should I be?"
"Most people are when talking to the FBI.
"It's not that different from talking with..."
She bites her chapped lower lip, winces at the beads of blood that seep through the cracked skin. She takes another sip.
"With?"
he prompts gently.
"Him?"
she answers.
"The gardener?"
"The man who held you, you talked with his gardener?"
She shakes her head.
"He was the gardener."
"You have to understand, I didn't give him that name out of fear or reverence or some misguided sense of propriety. I didn't give him that name at all. Like anything else in that place, it was made up out of the whole cloth of our ignorance. What wasn't known was created. What wasn't created eventually ceased to matter. It's a form of pragmatism, I suppose. Warm, loving people who desperately need approval from others fall victim to Stockholm Syndrome, while the rest of us fall to pragmatism. Having seen both sides in others, I'm for pragmatism. I heard the name my first day in the garden. I came to with a splitting headache, 100 times worse than any hangover I'd ever experienced. I couldn't even open my eyes at first. Pain lanced through my skull with every breath, let alone movement. I must have made a sound, because suddenly there was a cool, damp cloth over my forehead and eyes, and a voice promising that it was only water. I wasn't sure which unnerved me more, the fact that this was obviously a frequent concern for her, or the fact that it was a her at all. There'd been no woman in the pair that kidnapped me, of that much I was sure. An arm slid behind my shoulders, gently pulling me upright, and a hand pressed a glass against my lips. "Just water, I promise," she said again. I drank. It didn't really matter if it was just water or not.
"Can you swallow pills?"
"Yes," I whispered, and even that much sound drove another nail through my skull.
"Open up, then."
When I obeyed, she placed 2 flat pills on my tongue and brought the water up again. I swallowed obediently, then tried not to vomit when she gently lowered me back to a cool sheet and a firm mattress. She didn't say anything else for a long time, not until the colored lights stopped dancing across the backs of my eyelids and I started to move of my own volition. Then she pulled away the cloth across my face, shielding my eyes from the overhead light until I could stop blinking.
"So you've done this a few times before," I croaked.
She handed me the glass of water. Even folded over on herself, on a stool beside the bed, it was easy to see that she was tall. Tall and sinewy, with long legs and lean muscles, like an Amazon. Or a lioness, really, because she slumped bonelessly like a cat. Tawny gold hair was piled atop her head in some fancy nonsense, revealing a face with strong architecture and deep brown eyes with flecks of gold. She wore a silky black dress that tied high around her neck. She accepted my frank appraisal with something like relief. I suppose it was better than shrieking hysterics, which she'd probably gotten before.
"I'm called Lionette," she said,
when I'd looked my fill and given my attention back to the water.
"Don't bother telling me your name, because I won't be able to use it. Best to forget it, if you can."
"Where are we?"
"The garden."
"Garden?"
She shrugged, and even that was a fluid gesture, something graceful rather than inelegant.
"It's as good a name for it as any. You want to see it?"
"I don't suppose you know a shortcut to a way out of here?"
She just looked at me.
"Right."
I swung my legs over the edge of the bed, planted my fists on the mattress, and realized I could see every bit of me there was to see.
"Clothing?"
"Here."
She handed me a piece of silky, black something that proved to be a slinky, knee-length dress that came high around the neck and low on the back. Really low. If I'd had dimples on my ass, she'd have been seeing them. She helped me tie the ropey sash around my hips, then gave me a gentle push toward the doorway. The room was plain, severely so, with nothing in it but the bed and a small toilet and sink in one corner. In another corner was what seemed to be a tiny open shower. The walls were made of thick glass, with a doorway in place of a door, and there was a track on either side of the glass. Lionette saw me looking at the track marks and scowled.
"Solid walls come down to keep us in our rooms and out of sight," she explained.
"Often?"
"Sometimes."
The doorway opened into a narrow hallway, running along to my right, but only a short way on my left before it hit a corner. Almost directly across from the doorway was another entryway with more of that tracking. It led into a cave, damp and cool. An open arch on the far side of the cave brought breezes running through the dark stone space, bits of light catching in the waterfall that babbled and churned just outside. Lionette led me out from behind the curtain of water into a garden so beautiful it nearly hurt to look at it. Brilliant flowers of every conceivable color bloomed in a riotous profusion of leaves and trees, clouds of butterflies drifting through them. A man-made cliff rose above us, more greenery and trees alive on its flat top, and the trees on the edges just brushed the sides of the glass roof that loomed impossibly far away. I could see tall black walls through the lower-level greenery, too tall to see what was beyond, and little pockets of open space surrounded by vines. I thought they might be doorways to halls like the one we'd been in. The atrium was massive, almost overwhelming in its sheer size, before you even looked at the riot of color. The waterfall fed into a narrow stream that meandered down to a small pond decked in water lilies, white sand paths tracking through the greenery to those other doors. The light through the ceiling was deep lavender and streaked through with rose and indigo. Evening. It had been bright afternoon when I was taken, but somehow I didn't think it was the same day. I turned in a slow circle, trying to take it all in, but it was too much. My eyes couldn't see half of what was there, and my brain couldn't process half of what I saw. The fuck? Lionette actually laughed, a hard sound that abruptly cut short, as though she were afraid anyone might hear it.
We call him the gardener, she said dryly. Apt, no?
What is this place?
Welcome to the butterfly garden.
I turned to ask her what that meant. But then I saw it.
She takes a long sip of water, rolling the bottle across her palms. When she shows no signs of continuing, Victor gently taps the table to get her attention. It? He prompts. She doesn't answer. Victor pulls the photo from his jacket pocket, laying it on the table between them. It? He asks again.
See, asking me questions to which you already know the answer doesn't make me inclined to trust you.
But her shoulders relax, and she leans back into the seat on familiar footing. We're the FBI. Usually people think we're the good guys.
And Hitler thought he was evil?
Edison lurches to the very edge of his seat.
You're comparing the FBI to Hitler?
No, I'm engaging in a discussion about perspective and moral relativity.
When they got the call, Ramirez went straight to the hospital, and Victor came here to coordinate the deluge of incoming information. Edison was the one to tour the property. Edison always reacts to horror with temper. And with that thought, Victor flicks his eyes back to the girl on the other side of the table. Did it hurt?
Like hell,
she answers, tracing the lines on the photo. The hospital says it's a few years old?
You make that sound like a question.
A statement seeking confirmation. He clarifies, and this time the smile creeps out. Edison scowls at him.
Hospitals are many things, but completely incompetent doesn't tend to be one of them.
And what the hell does that mean? Snaps Edison.
Yes, it's a few years old.
He recognizes the patterns now from years of asking his daughters about report cards and tests and boyfriends. He lets the silence hang for a minute, then two, and watches the girl carefully flip the photo over. The shrinks on the larger team would probably have a thing or three to say about that.
Who did he have do it? The one person in the world he could trust without reservation.
Multi-talented man.
Vic!
Without taking his eyes from the girl, Victor kicks the leg of his partner's chair, jarring him. He's rewarded with that suggestion of a smile. Not the real thing, not even a ghost of it, really, but something like it. The girl peeks under the edge of the gauze taped around her fingers, fashioned like gloves rather than mitts.
The needles make a hell of a sound, don't they, when it's not what you choose? But it is a choice, because there is the alternative.
Death, Victor guesses.
Worse.
Worse than death. But Edison pales, and the girl sees, and rather than mocking him for it, she gives him a solemn nod.
He knows. But then, you haven't been there, have you? Reading about it isn't the same.
What's worse than death, Maya? She scrapes a nail under one of the fresh scabs on her index finger, peeling it away so dots of blood blossom against the gauze.
You'd be amazed at how easy it is to get tattoo equipment.
For the first week, there was something slipped into my dinner each night to make me docile. Lionette stayed with me during the days, but the other girls, of which there were apparently more than a few, stayed away. This was normal, she told me when I remarked on it over lunch.
The weeping thing stresses everyone out, she said, around a mouthful of salad.
Whatever else could be said of the mysterious gardener, he provided excellent meals.
Most prefer to stay out of it until we know how a girl's going to settle in.
Except for you.
Someone has to do it. I can put up with the tears if I have to.
Then how grateful you must be that I haven't provided you with any.
About that.
Lionette stabbed a strip of grilled chicken and twirled her fork.
Have you cried at all?
Would there be a point to doing so?
I'm either going to love you or hate you.
Let me know. I'll try to behave accordingly. She gave me a fierce smile, all her teeth showing.
Keep that attitude, but don't do it with him.
Why does he want me sleeping at night?
Precautionary measures. There's a cliff right outside, after all.
Which made me wonder, how many girls had thrown themselves over before he implemented those precautionary measures? I tried to gauge the height of the man-made monstrosity. 25, maybe 30 feet? Was that high enough to kill someone on impact? I'd grown accustomed to waking up in that empty room when the drugs wore off, Lionette sitting on a stool beside the bed. But at the end of the first week, I woke up on my stomach, on a bench, with hard padding, and the astringent smell of antiseptic thick in the air. It was a different room, larger, with metal walls rather than glass. And it had someone else in it. I couldn't see at first, not with the drugged sleep still seaming my eyelids together, but I could feel someone else there. I kept my breathing slow and even, straining to hear, but a hand settled on my bare calf.
I know you're awake.
It was a man's voice, mid-range and cultured with a mid-Atlantic cast to it. A pleasant voice. The hand smoothed up my leg, over my ass, and along the curve of my back. Goosebumps prickled in its wake, despite the warmth of the room.
I'd prefer for you to lie very still. Otherwise, we'll both have cause to regret it.
When I tried to turn my head toward his voice, the hand moved to the back of my skull to keep me still.
I would prefer not to bind you for this. It ruins the line of the work. If you feel you cannot remain motionless, I will give you something that will guarantee it. Again, I would prefer not to. Can you be still?
Or? I asked, almost in a whisper. He tucked a glossy, smooth piece of paper into my hand. I tried to open my eyes, but sleep meds always made them gunk up more than usual in the morning.
If you're not going to start right now, may I please sit up?
The hand stroked my hair, the fingernails scraping lightly against my scalp.
You may,
he said, sounding startled. He did, however, help me sit up on the bench. I rubbed the crystals from my eyes and looked down at the picture in my hand, aware of how his hand kept caressing my hair. I thought of Lionette, of the other girls I'd seen from a distance, and I couldn't say I was surprised. Creeped out, but not surprised. He stood behind me, the air around him filled with a spicy cologne. Understated, probably pricey. In front of me was a full tattooist setup, the inks arrayed on a standing tray.
It won't be the full design today.
Why do you mark us?
Because a garden must have its butterflies.
Any chance we could leave that metaphorical? He laughed, a full, easy sound. This was a man who loved to laugh, and didn't find as much cause to do it as he'd like, and was therefore always delighted by the opportunity. You learn things over time, and that was one of the biggest things I learned about him. He wanted to find more joy in life than he did.
Small wonder my Lionette likes you. You are a fierce spirit, much like she is.
I didn't have an answer to that, nothing that made sense to say. He carefully hooked his fingers through my hair, pulling it back over my shoulders, and picked up a brush. He worked it through my hair until there wasn't a single knot to be found, and even after. I think he enjoyed it as much as anything else, really. It's a simple pleasure, brushing someone else's hair. Being allowed to. Eventually, he pulled it into a ponytail and wrapped it with an elastic, then coiled it into a heavy bun and secured it with a scrunchie and rubber-tipped pins.
Back onto your stomach now, please.
I obeyed, and as he moved away, I caught a glimpse of pressed khakis and a button-down shirt. He turned my head to face away from him, my cheek pressed against the black leather, and placed my arms loosely at my sides. It wasn't quite comfortable, but it wasn't direly uncomfortable either. When I steeled myself not to jump or flinch, he lightly slapped my rear.
Relax, he instructed. If you tense, it will hurt more and take longer to heal.
I took a deep breath and forced my muscles to unclench. I curled and uncurled my fists, and with each uncurl I released a bit more tension from my back. Sophia taught us that, mainly to keep Whitney from her periodic breakdowns and...
Sophia? Whitney? These are some of the girls?
Edison interrupts. They're girls, yes. Well, Sophia probably counts as a woman.
The girl takes another sip, eyes the quantity left in the bottle.
Actually, Whitney would too, I guess. So, they're women.
What do they look like? We can match their names to...
They're not from the garden.
It's hard to interpret the look she gives the younger agent, equal parts pity, amusement, and derision.
I had a life before, you know. Life didn't begin at the garden. Well, not this garden, anyway.
Victor turns the photo over, trying to calculate how long such a thing must have taken. So large, so much detail.
It wasn't all at once,
the girl tells him, following his eyes to the pattern.
He started with the outlines, then he went back in over the course of 2 weeks to add in all the color and detail. And when it was done, there I was, just another one of the butterflies in his garden. God, creating his own little world.
Tell us about Sophia and Whitney, Victor says, content to leave the tattoo for a time. He has a feeling what happened when it was done, and he's willing to call himself a coward if it means not hearing it yet.
I lived with them.
Edison tugs the moleskin from his pocket.
Where? In our apartment.
You need... Victor cuts him off.
Tell us about the apartment.
Vic, Edison protests. She's not giving us anything.
She will, he answers, when she's ready.
The girl watches them without comment, sliding the bottle from hand to hand like a hockey puck.
Tell us about the apartment, he says again.
There were 8 of us who lived there, all of us working together at the restaurant. It was a huge loft apartment, all one room, with beds and footlockers laid out like a barracks. Each bed had a hanging rack for clothing on one side, and rods for curtains on the other side and at the foot of the bed. It wasn't much for privacy, but it worked well enough. Under normal circumstances, rent would have been hellish, but it was a shit neighborhood, and there were so many of us that you could make your rent in a night or two, and call the rest of the month spending money. Some even did. We were a strange mix, students and hoydens and a retired hooker. Some wanted the freedom to be anyone they wanted. Some of us wanted the freedom to be left alone. The only things we had in common were working at the restaurant and living together. And honestly, it was kind of like heaven. Sure, we clashed sometimes. There were arguments and fights and occasional pettiness. But for the most part, those things blew over pretty quickly. Someone was always willing to loan you a dress or a pair of shoes or a book. There was work, classes for those who took them, but otherwise we had money and an entire city at our feet. Even for me, who grew up with minimal supervision, that kind of freedom was wonderful. The fridge was kept stocked with bagels, booze, and bottled water, and there were always condoms and aspirin in the cabinets. Sometimes you could find leftover takeout in the fridge, and whenever social services came to visit Sophia and see how she was improving, we made a grocery run and hid the booze and condoms. Mostly we ate out or had things delivered. Working around food every night, we generally avoided the apartment kitchen like the plague. Oh, and the drunk guy. We were never sure if he actually lived in the building or not, but in the afternoons we'd see him drinking in the street, and every night he'd pass out in front of our door. Not the building door, our door. He was a fucking pervert, too. So when we came back after dark, which was pretty much every night, we took the stairs all the way up to the roof, and then came down one floor on the fire escape to come in through the windows. Our landlord put a special lock on there for us, because Sophia felt bad for the drunk pervert and didn't want to turn him over to the cops. Given her situation, retired hooker, drug addict cleaning up to try to get her kids back, the rest of us didn't push. The girls were my first friends. I suppose I'd met people like them before, but it was different. I could stay away from people, and usually did. But I worked with the girls, and then I lived with them, and it was just different. There was Sophia, who mothered everyone and had managed to be completely clean for over a year when I met her, and that was after 2 years of trying and slipping. She had the two most beautiful daughters, and had actually been kept together in the same foster home. Even better, the foster parents fully supported Sophia's goal of earning them back. They let her come to see the girls pretty much whenever she wanted. Whenever things got rough, whenever the addiction started screaming again, one of us would stuff her in a taxi to see her girls and remind her what she was working so hard for. There was Hope and her little stooge, Jessica. Hope was the one with the ideas, with the vivacity, and Jessica went along with everything she said and did. Hope filled the apartment with laughter and sex, and if Jessica used sex as a way to feel better about herself, at least Hope showed her how to have some fun with it. They were the babies, only 16 and 17 when I moved in. Amber was also 17, but unlike the other two, she had a bit of a plan. She got herself declared an emancipated minor so she could get out of the foster system, took her GED, and was taking classes at a community college to get her AA until she could figure out a major. There was Catherine, a couple of years older, who never, ever talked about life before the apartment. Or about much of anything, really. Catherine could sometimes be prevailed upon to go with the rest of us to do something, but she never did anything on her own. If someone lined all eight of us against a wall and asked who was running from something or someone, a person would point to Catherine every time. We didn't ask her, though. One of the basic rules of the apartment was that we didn't push on personal history. We all had baggage. Whitney, I mentioned, she of the periodic breakdowns. She was a grad student in psychology, but was so fucking high-strung. Not in a bad way, just in an I-don't-react-to-stress-well kind of way. Between semesters, she was fantastic. During semesters, we all took turns getting her to chill the fuck out. Noemi was also a student, getting one of the most useless degrees known to man. Really, I think the only reason she was going to college was because she had scholarships, and getting an English degree gave her an excuse to read a lot. Luckily, she was very generous in sharing her books. Noemi was the one who mentioned the apartment to me, my second week at the restaurant. It was my third week in the city, and I was still living at a hostel, bringing all my worldly possessions to work with me every day. We were in the tiny staff room, changing out of our uniforms. I kept mine at the restaurant just in case my stuff got stolen while I was sleeping, so at least I'd still be able to work. Everyone else changed there because the uniform, a long dress and heels, just wasn't the sort of thing they pranced around in on their way home.
So, you're pretty trustworthy, right?
She said, with no preamble. I mean, you don't stiff the busboys or hostess, you don't steal anyone's stuff from the staff room. You never smell of drugs or anything. Does this have a point? I pulled on my bra and fastened the hooks behind me, rearranging my breasts to fit. Living in a hostel gave you a certain lack of modesty, one reinforced by the tiny staff room and the number of female employees who had to change there. Rebecca said you're just a step up from the street. You know a bunch of us live together, right? Well, we've got an extra bed. She's serious, called Whitney, fluffing her red gold hair out of its braided bun. It's a bed. And a footlocker, giggled Hope. But we've been talking about it and wondered if you'd like to move in. Rent will be $300 a month, includes utilities. I hadn't been in the city that long, but even I knew that was impossible. $300? The hell you get for $300? Rent is $2,000, Sophia corrected. Share of rent would be $300. The extra is what covers the utilities. That sounded about right, except... How many of you live there? You will make 8. Which wouldn't make it that different from living in the hostel, really. Can I stay with you tonight and see it, and decide tomorrow? Sounds great. Hope handed me a denim skirt that looked barely long enough to cover my underwear. That's not mine. I know, but I think it would look really cute on you. She was already one leg into my overlarge corduroys, so rather than argue, I shimmied into the skirt and decided to be very careful in bending over. Hope was curvy as hell, running a little to plump, so I could pull the skirt low on my hips for a little extra length. The owner's eyes lit up when he saw me leaving with the girls.
You live with them now, yes? You'll be safe.
The customers are gone, Julian. He dropped the Italian accent and clapped me on the shoulder.
They're good girls. I'm glad you'll be with them.
His opinion went a long way toward convincing me even before I saw the apartment. My first impression of Julian had been hard but fair, and he proved me right when he offered a trial week to a girl with a duffel bag and a suitcase beside her at the interview. He pretended to be native Italian because it made the customers somehow think the food was better, but he was a tall, heavy-set ginger with thinning hair and a mustache that had eaten his upper lip and was now seeking to devour the rest of his face. He believed a person's work was a better judge than their words, and he appraised people accordingly. At the end of my first week, he simply handed me the schedule for the next week with my name inked in. It was 3 a.m. when we left. I memorized the streets and the trains, and wasn't nearly as nervous as I should have been when we walked into their neighborhood. On feet, aching from hours of high heels, we trudged up the many flights of stairs to the top floor, and then to the roof, weaving through various patio furniture, covered grills, and what looked to be a flourishing marijuana garden in one corner, and down one flight on the fire escape to the large bank of windows. Sophia worked the key into the lock as Hope giggled her way through an explanation of the drunk pervert in the hallway. We had a few of those at the hostel. It was a huge space, open and clean, with 4 beds lining each sidewall and a group of couches clustered together in a square in the center. The kitchen had an island counter to separate it from the rest of the room, and a door led off to the bathroom, which had a huge open shower with 10 different heads facing different directions.
We don't ask questions about the people who lived here before,
Noemi said delicately when she showed it to me.
It's just a shower, though, not an orgy.
You convince maintenance of this?
Oh, no, we fuck with them all the time. Let's have the fun.
I smiled in spite of myself. The girls were fun to work with, always tossing jokes and insults and compliments around the kitchen, venting about irritating customers or flirting with the cooks and dishwashers. I'd smiled more in the past 2 weeks than I could ever remember doing before. Everyone dropped purses and bags on their footlockers, and many of them changed into pajamas, or what passed for them, but sleep was a long way off yet. Whitney pulled out her psychology textbook, while Amber pulled out 20 shot glasses and filled them with tequila. I reached for one, but Noemi handed me a tumbler of vodka instead.
The tequila is for studying.
So I sat on one of the couches and watched Catherine read through Amber's practice test, 1 shot glass for each question. If Amber got the question wrong, she had to drink the shot. If she got it right, she could make someone else drink it, She handed the first one to me, and I tried not to choke on the nastiest shit mix of tequila and vodka. We were still awake when daylight came, and Noemi, Amber, and Whitney all trundled off to class while the rest of us finally crashed. When we woke up, early in the afternoon, I signed the agreement they had in place of a lease and paid my first month from the past two nights' tips. Just like that, I wasn't homeless anymore.
You said this was your third week in the city, Victor asks, running through a list of cities she might mean. Her voice is clean of larger dialect markers, no regionalisms that could help identify her origin. He's fairly sure that's on purpose.
That's right.
Where were you before that? She finishes off the water rather than answer. Carefully standing the empty bottle on one corner of the table, she sits back in the chair and slowly rubs her bandaged hands up and down her arms. Victor stands and shrugs out of his jacket, walking around the table to drape it over her shoulders. She tenses as he walks near, but he takes care not to let his skin brush hers. When he returns to his side of the table, she relaxes enough to slide her arms through. It's large on her, draping in baggy folds, but her hands emerge comfortably from the cuffs. New York City, he decides. Warehouse-style apartments, restaurants open extremely late. Plus, she said trains instead of metro or subway. That meant something, didn't it? He makes a mental note to contact the New York office and see if they can find anything on the girl. Were you in school?
No, just work.
A tap on the window sends Edison out of the room. The girl watches him leave with some satisfaction, then turns a neutral expression back on Victor. What made you decide to go to the city? He asks. It doesn't sound like you knew anyone there. Didn't have a plan for when you got there. Why go?
Why not? It's something new, right? Something different?
Something distant? She arches an eyebrow. What is your name?
The gardener called me Maya.
But that wasn't what you were before.
Sometimes it was easier to forget, you know?
She fidgets with the edge of the cuffs, rolling and unrolling them with quick motions. Probably not much different than rolling silverware sets when it came to it.
You were in there, no chance of escape, no way of going back to the life you knew, so why cling to it? Why cause yourself more pain by remembering what you don't get to have anymore?
Are you saying you forgot?
I'm saying he called me Maya.
I was mostly isolated from the other girls until my tattoo was finished, with the exception of Lionette, who still came every day to talk with me, to rub ointment over my raw back. She let me study her mark with no sign of shame or disgust. It was a part of her now, like breathing, like the unconscious grace of her movements. The level of detail was stunning, and I wondered how much the intricacy suffered when it came time to refresh the brightness of the ink. Something kept me from asking, though. A good tattoo took years to fade enough that it needed to be touched up. I didn't want to think about what it would mean to be in the garden for that long. Or worse, what it could mean if I wasn't. The drugs still appeared in my dinner, which Lionette brought to me on a tray, along with her own. Every few days I woke up, not in the bed, but on the hard leather bench, with the gardener running his hands along the previously inked areas to test how they were healing, how sensitive they were. He never let me see him. And unlike my room with its semi-reflective glass everywhere, the dull metal walls gave me no hope of catching a glimpse. He hummed as he worked, a sound that was somewhat lovely on its own, but clashed horribly with the mechanical hum of the needles. Golden oldies, mostly. Elvis, Sinatra, Martin, Crosby, even some Andrews sisters. It was a strange kind of pain. Choosing to lie there under the needles and let him write his ownership into my skin. I didn't see that I had many options, though. Lionette said she stayed with each girl until the wings were done. I couldn't explore the garden yet, couldn't look for a way out. I wasn't sure yet if Lionette knew there was no way out or if she just didn't care anymore. so I let him put those damn wings on me. I never asked what would happen if I fought, if I refused. I almost did, but Lionette paled, so I changed the question to something else. I thought it had something to do with the way she never took me through the halls, only out into the garden itself, through the cave behind the waterfall. Whatever she didn't want me to see, or didn't want to show me, which isn't the same thing at all, I could wait. Cowardly, I guess. Or pragmatic. It was near the end of the third week in the garden that he finished. All morning he'd been more intense, more focused, had taken fewer and shorter breaks. The first day he'd inked along my spine and worked in the outline for the wings and the veins and the blocks of the larger patterns. After that, he'd started at the wingtips and worked his way back in toward my spine, rotating between the four quadrants of my back to keep any one area from getting unworkably raw. He was nothing if not meticulous. Then the hum stopped, and his breaths were short and fast as he wiped away the blood and excess ink. His hands trembled at their work, where before they'd been nothing but steady. Cold, slick ointment came next, rubbed carefully into every inch of skin.
"You're exquisite," he said hoarsely. "Absolutely flawless. Truly a worthy addition to my garden. And now? Now you must have a name."
His thumbs stroked along my spine, where the first ink was done and the most healed, traveling up to the nape of my neck to tangle in my pulled-up hair. Greasy ointment clung to his hands, leaving my hair matted and heavy in his wake. Without warning, he pulled me down the bench until my feet were on the floor, my upper half still on the leather. I could hear him fumbling with his belt and zipper, and I screwed my eyes tightly shut.
"Maya,"
he groaned, running his hands along my sides.
"You are Maya now. Mine."
A hard knock on the door stops her from describing what came next, and she looks both startled and grateful. Victor swears under his breath and lurches out of his chair to the door, jerking it open. Edison motions him into the hallway. "What the hell is wrong with you?" he hisses. "She was actually talking." "The team going through the suspect's office found something." He holds up a large evidence bag filled with driver's licenses and identification cards. "Looks like he kept all of them." All of them that had one, anyway. He takes the bag. Christ, that's a lot of cards. And shakes it a little to see past the first layer of names and pictures. "Did you find hers?" Edison hands him a different bag. A small one holding a sole piece of plastic. It's a New York ID, and he recognizes her immediately. A little younger, her face softer, even if her expression isn't. "Inara Morrissey," he reads, but Edison shakes his head. "They've scanned the rest and are starting to run them, but they put this one first. Inara Morrissey didn't exist until 4 years ago. The Social Security number matches a 2-year-old's who died in the 70s. New York office is sending someone to the last listed place of employment, a restaurant named Evening Star. The address on the ID is a condemned building, but we called the restaurant and got the apartment address. The agent I talked to whistled when he gave it to me. Apparently it's a rough neighborhood." "She told us that," Victor says absently.
"Yeah. She's so trustworthy and forthcoming."
He doesn't answer right away, absorbed in studying the ID. He believes his partner that it's a fake, but damn, what a fake. Under ordinary circumstances, he has to admit he'd be fooled by it. "When did she stop showing up for work?"
"2 years ago, according to her boss. Taxes support it."
2 years. He hands the larger bag back and folds the plastic bag around the single ID until he can tuck it into his back pocket. "Have them run these as quickly as possible. Borrow techs from other teams if they can get away with it. Identifying the girls in the hospital has to be a priority. Then get us a couple of earbuds so the techs can pass along updates from the New York office."
"Got it."
He scowls at the closed door.
"Was she actually talking?"
talking hasn't exactly been her problem, he chuckles. Get married, Edison, or better yet, have teenage daughters. She's better than most, but the patterns are there. You just have to parse through the information for what's significant. Listen to what isn't being said. There's a reason I prefer to talk to suspects rather than victims. He stalks into the tech room without waiting for a response. As long as he's out of the room, he might as well make use of the break. Victor walks briskly down the hall and out into the team's main room, weaving through desks and partial cubes to the corner that serves as a kitchen or break room. He pulls the coffee pot from the machine and gives it a judicious sniff. It's not hot, but it doesn't smell completely stale either. He pours it into two mugs that look clean and pops them in the microwave. While they nuke, he digs through the fridge for anything that might be open season. Birthday cake isn't quite what he's looking for, but it'll serve. And soon he has paper plates loaded with two thick slices and several packets of sugar and creamer. He hooks his fingers through the handles of the mugs and returns to the tech room. Edison scowls but holds the plates for him so he can insert the earbud. Victor doesn't try to hide the wire. The girl's too smart for that. When he's got it settled comfortably, he takes the plates back and enters the room. He startles her with the cake, and he carefully hides a smile as he slides one of the plates and a mug across the stainless steel surface. I thought you might be hungry. I don't know how you like your coffee.
I don't, but thank you.
She sips the coffee black, makes a face, but swallows and takes another mouthful. He waits until her mouth is full of a red frosting rose. Tell me about the evening star, Inara. She doesn't choke, doesn't flinch, but there's the slightest pause, a moment of absolute stillness that's gone so fast he wouldn't have seen it if he weren't looking for it. She swallows and licks the frosting from her lips, leaving streaks of brilliant red across them.
It's a restaurant, but then you know that.
He pulls the ID from his pocket and places it and the bag on the table. She taps a fingernail against the ID, intermittently obscuring her face.
He kept them?
She asks incredulously.
That seems...
foolish?
Sure.
Her face pulls into a thoughtful frown, and her fingers flatten to hide the plastic card from view.
All of them?
As far as we can tell. She swirls the coffee in the mug, staring at the tiny maelstrom. But Inara is as much a construction as Maya, isn't it? He asks gently. Your name, your age, none of it's real.
It's real enough,
she corrects softly.
Real for what it needs to be.
Real enough to get a job and a place to live. But what came before?
One of the nice things about New York was that no one ever asked questions. It's just one of those places people go to, you know? It's a dream, it's a goal, it's a place you can disappear amidst millions of other people doing the same thing. No one cares where you came from or why you left because they're too focused on themselves and what they want and where they're going. New York has so much history, but everyone in it just wants to know about the future. Even when you're from New York City, you can still go to ground somewhere else and they may never find you. I took the bus to New York with everything I owned in a duffel bag and a suitcase. I found a soup kitchen that didn't care if I slept in the clinic upstairs as long as I helped serve food, and one of the other volunteers told me about a guy who had just made him papers for his wife, who was an illegal from Venezuela. I called the number he gave me, and the next day I was at the library, sitting under a statue of a lion and waiting for a complete stranger to approach me. He didn't inspire much confidence when he finally appeared, an hour and a half after we'd agreed. He was average height and skinny, his clothes stiff with salt and other stains I didn't want to identify. His lank hair was in the process of matting into dreads, and he sniffled constantly, his eyes darting around each time before he lifted a sleeve to rub at his cherry-red nose. Maybe he was a genius at forgery?